Right, everybody. Welcome to finally another episode of Cube and Chaos. We found ourselves another great guest. Today with us is Derek.
Hello, everybody.
I heard that every Cube podcast needs to have him on as soon as possible. Otherwise, they will not be considered quality anymore. So we made that happen. And as always, here is also Max.
Hello. Yes. Yeah. You know, I can't say I'm a Cube podcast staple the way Derek is, but I'm still here. So
I like that I go from like I do a podcast and then all of a sudden I'm a podcast staple. You know, I'll take it. But
yeah. Well, to kick things off, do you want to tell everyone a little bit about yourself through your signature spellbook?
Sure. I love this spellbook that you guys do. I think it's wonderful. So I spent a little bit of time on this and I gave myself some restrictions, which is kind of, I think, my thing. So I was thinking about what you said about spellbooks. Just give me 8 cards or whatever that would be in your spellbook. And then I was reading up on what spellbooks were because I wanted to refresh myself. I decided that they tended to be non-creatures. So I'm going with non-creature spells that are all in some ways emblematic of my history playing the game and a little allow me to branch out into like maybe some discussions on like card design or like memories of major events in my Magic, like my relationship to the game. So I'm going to try to go in chronological order, but I might mess up a couple of these along the way. So the first card in my signature spellbook is Giant Growth. I picked Giant Growth because, I mean, straight up, I think it is my favorite design of any Magic card. And I love that it's from the first set. It's my favorite design because it's really clear what's going on from a storytelling perspective. And also, it's so simple and elegant as a pump spell that the utility of it is tremendous. I think it's just a beautiful card. And it's kind of instructive in a lot of ways as to how we look at early Magic or like what's going on the battlefield. So Giant Growth, it's got to be there. I mean, I started playing Magic in 1994. My first set I was playing with in physically in my hands was Revised. And so I had to pick something from Revised, basically, that meant a lot to me. I could have picked a lot of cards that resonated with me from that set, but choosing to lean a little bit towards card design or like something that really just stuck with me over the years. And I mean, Giant Growth is just a perfect Magic card in my estimation.
It's a nice choice. Yeah. It really a design that stood the test of time. Like not only is it resonant and like worked well then, but still it appears in sets now. It's still reasonably powerful, just like then, I would say. But yeah, was there ever a time where it was like broken, or was it always just a good limited card, nice for kitchen table Magic?
It just tells a really good story and it teaches you something about the game. And I think that level of like clean onboarding into understanding sort of how the game plays is just a really hard thing to do. It's good to be reminded in 2023 when we're dealing with it's just such increased complexity in card designs that these old solutions are still so relevant today.
Yep.
For sure, yeah. There's still some simplicity and still some elegance in the game. I'm not familiar with Magic's kind of ancient history well enough to say whether there was a point where it was broken, but I can tell you that there was pretty much a time when Giant Growth was phased out of limited printings. It was kind of unofficially, I think, too good for limited for a while, and we got like a number of +2/+2s and then like something else, something very small tacked on to that for the same cost. And so yeah, it's interesting, we've kind of like moved back into the direction of Giant Growth being, you know, like a suitable card again with the Brothers War. I think that's probably the most recent set it was printed
It was printed the Brothers War, and I think it was printed in, was it Strixhaven or like somewhere in 2021 as well?
Wasn't in Strixhaven, I just played that, it's not in that, but...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but what I'm thinking about with what Max just said, is it maybe that the card is too well designed? Like, it hit the spot with casting cost and effect so well that they can't really add something extra for that mana cost, and that's maybe why they phased it out to, like, open up the design space of one mana green combat tricks.
Well, Maybe they decided to phase it out so they could make room for Lightning Bolt and Doomblade. I'm not too sure about that.
Find specifically the time period that I'm talking about where it wasn't printed. It feels to me like there's kind of a big gap between, I want to say, like Return to Ravnica and like the next time it was printed, but I could be mistaken there. But yeah, I was thinking about what you were saying, Crackshot, and like there's never really been like a strictly better giant growth, right? And so like for them to undershoot it slightly, yeah, I think that's an interesting point, and maybe it does open up some design space to exclude it.
I like that. Okay, so next card in my spellbook is an absolutely a terrible magic card, but it's important in my personal history, which is Abeyance. Do you both know what Abeyance is?
It's a white cantrip, right?
You could call it a white cantrip, yes. It does have an effect and then draws a card. Maybe there's an Oracle wording of it now. I'm actually going to look it up. But the reason I'm bringing it up is actually just really, really funny. Until end of turn, the original wording is, target player cannot play instants, interrupts, sorceries, or abilities requiring an activation cost. Draw a card. That's the original text on it. Okay, so this was somehow eroded or cleaned up a little bit, and there's a really good reason why. So, as either or one of you may know or hear about, or have heard about, is that old magic, is especially competitive magic or constructed magic, was really overrun by like broken, unfair, and ultimately kind of like grifter cards. And Abeyance was, for a very small period of time, was one of the most egregious grief cards that was ever printed. So there was an interpretation of the rules back then in 1997 when this came out that the phrase abilities requiring an activation cost meant lands. How we got to that point, I don't know. But it was explained to me at a tournament, and my opponent played four copies of Abeyance, and they played it in a blue-white control deck that used Browse and Soldevi Digger to basically deck themselves and use Soldevi Digger to put cards back on the bottom of their library, which, if you're browsing, you're through your entire library. Browse, by the way, is a four-mana enchantment that is an activated ability that says, look at the top five, put one in your hand, and exile the rest. Or top four, or something like that. So you get to this game state where you have no cards in your library. You have a Soldevi Digger in play. Soldevi Digger is an artifact that lets you pay two mana and put a card from your graveyard on the bottom of your library. So you get to a point where you're just abeyancing your opponent over and over and over and over and over again, and they can't do anything, and you win the game by decking them.
That's so horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, this card is awful. You know, now it says activated abilities that aren't mana abilities. Which I'm not even sure is like even like so much a fix as like who convinced whoever that activated or abilities require an activation cost meant lands. Like tap is a cost for a basic land. It was just miserable. And so I played this deck. I obviously went out and of course I'm going to buy four copies of Abeyance and I'm going to, you know, Abeyance and Kjeldurin Outpost and Soldevi Digger and Browse my opponent until they literally just don't want to play with me anymore. It's actually a wonder why people even continue to play the game with each other, you know, in a lot of these settings, because it was just such a net, like it was super, super zero sum with a lot of my memories of tournament level Magic. And Abeyance is like terrible design, unfun, miserable to play against back then, but it's a core piece of my memory of playing tournament Magic as a kid. So
it reminds me of Nexus of Fate a little bit, what you just said.
Yeah. Nexus had a very similar play pattern to these kinds of decks. These total super inevitability control decks. So had to put that one in there. Next one is Recurring Nightmare. Recurring Nightmare, for those of you who don't know, is two and a black for an enchantment. It's the activation cost is return it to its hand. Very important that's the activation cost. Return it to its hand. And then you get to sacrifice a creature you have in play and bring a creature from the graveyard into play on your side. And this card, when it was printed, it became my favorite card ever. I love black. It's my favorite color in Magic. Probably had a lot to do with that. And so I, you know, have very, very fond memories of playing with Survival of the Fittest, Recurring Nightmare, and Living Death in green-black mid-range toolbox decks that existed back then. I mean, that was by far and away my favorite deck before I, you know, stopped playing Magic at some point. And I still, you know, love seeing recurring Nightmare in cubes. I know people like to play recurring Nightmare in Commander. It still has a presence in Magic today. I also love the card because it tells a really good story. It does it with one of the worst things card design in Magic, which is repetitive gameplay. But it kind of works for the card's flavor in that it just keeps coming back and it's very hard to interact with. So I love that about the card. I love that it cares about things. It cares about creatures in the graveyard, cares about creatures in play. Back then, it was a little harder to do. Yeah, you had Survival of the Fittest, but, you know, just incidentally dumping cards in the graveyard from everything from Dredge to things like Seder Wayfinder and Citrus Supplier wasn't really a thing in the 90s. So you had to work for it a little bit, unless you got Survival, in which case it was easy. But Recurring Nightmare, great story, terrible gameplay, just repetitive gameplay. Just sucks. I mean, it's really powerful, but like that kind of stuff as somebody who's, you know, becoming interested in game design as an extreme amateur, but still love it. I find that's kind of stuff the easiest entry point to net unfun experiences.
Repetitiveness. That is.
Yeah. But it had to be in here. Recurring Nightmare had to be in.
Mostly said it all, but what was interesting was the comparison with Survival of the Fittest. Because that also changes a lot of things in Magic to make it less fun in a way. Because as soon as you have it, you have everything. Like, it makes everything super consistent.
Yeah.
And
as long as you have creatures in your hand, they become whatever you
exactly.
need.
Exactly. And then you combine super consistent with super repetitive, and you got yourself a deck.
Yeah. And you got yourself a constructed deck. Yeah. That's kind of how those things work sometimes. And I mean, it's again super powerful, but like you're just kind of doing the same thing over and over again, even though you have a toolbox deck. And you know, I will say, similarly to why Birthing Pod got banned, like when you have a card like Recurring Nightmare, the incentives are to find the best things to be doing with your creature, finding the best end of the battlefield abilities. It puts a lot of pressure on new creatures coming out. And, you know, one of the things that became even more unfun was when Urza's Legacy came out and Avalanche Riders was printed. And suddenly everyone was playing four Avalanche Riders in their Survival of the Fittest Recurring Nightmare deck because you got to keep you got to keep on griefing on because it's the 90s, baby. You know, similarly with why Birthing Pod got the axe in Modern, it sort of put pressure on Wizards. And whenever they printed a new really good creature with that entered the battlefield and did something powerful, it was going to go right into a Birthing Pod deck. Yeah. And there was just going to be this constant escalation of power for the Birthing Pod player. Okay, my next card. I guess this is going to be the last of the 90s picks, but it's an important one because it kind of put a good bit of punctuation on my relationship with Magic before I stopped playing the game for a while. And I couldn't decide which card to pick. So the card I'm going to talk about is Dream Halls, which is from, I believe, from Stronghold. It is from Stronghold, yes. So Dream Halls is an enchantment. It's a 3/2 blue, and it says instead of paying the mana cost for any of your spells, it's actually, it works for either player. Rather than pay the mana cost for a spell, its controller can discard a card that shares a color with that spell. So if I wanted to cast Fatal Push, once I have Dream Halls out, I can just discard a black card and I'll cast Fatal Push as an alternative cost, essentially. So you have every single card in your deck an alternative cost. So why am I picking this card? Well, first time I ever won a tournament was with this card. And it was during a lovely, lovely time in Magic's history where you got to play Memory Jar and Megrim and Lotus Petal and Time Spiral and all these just really fun Magic cards. I built a deck that ramped up into Dream Halls and then used Dream Halls to cast Mind Over Matter, which I could then tap and untap a land or a mana rock and then cast Stroke of Genius on my opponent and make them draw their whole deck. And I would do that with Time Spirals, and I would just generate an insane amount of mana by just being able to pitch cards to keep generating mana. Dream Halls was the linchpin card that let the deck go off. I had to pick this card because it was the first time I won a tournament. And, you know, in the finals against Memory Jar, of course. It was just peak. I mean, just peak. Nobody is doing and interacting at all with each other except in the hand. And nothing is, as we would come to call it, just fair magic. It was just all, it was magic back then, but horribly unfair. All of the stuff that was going on. This card is like also just a really just hilariously weird and kind of bad design. Like, it's a kind of a global effect. So everybody gets to start pitching cards to cast their spells. All of a sudden, it just matters how many cards are in your hand, and we're just casting things for free. It creates all these weird incentives that don't really line up with like how I like to play Magic now, especially. Doesn't really do anything on its own except make the game very strange. Dream Halls.
It's really weird. Like, it is a card that doesn't really work in most contexts. Like, in Constructed, you need to have really good card draw. Like, it's pretty easy to break, I guess, but you can't just play it in Limited. Like, if you played some Stronghold draft or something, it's probably wheeling. Unless somebody picks it for the monetary value.
Yeah, you're right. It doesn't do anything in of itself.
Yeah. And then granting that to your opponent also just seems like a terrible idea.
Yeah. Probably really fun in Commander, but, you know, that's, I can't really think of another reason I want
to. It would probably be fun unless you are really trying to break it. Just play it to see what happens with the game. I think that would be an interesting experiment, but probably somebody putting that into the deck has a plan to do some degenerate things. So I don't know. Actually fun.
I wonder how much of that is like attitude. I wonder if things just like become less fun if someone is like just thinking about the draft like a different way than other people. Like if three people, for instance, are there in your Dream Halls Commander game and they're just like there to have fun and mess around, and then the fourth person is like, nah, I'm gonna kill you all. Like, does that just ruin it? I feel like it might.
Now we're entering into the Commander discourse part of the podcast.
I don't think this was on the agenda, but
somebody tweeted this week, all conversations about Magic are actually about Commander.
Yeah, it's true though. I don't even play it, but it's just, it pops up everywhere all the time, so you can't not think about it. So it's the reality now.
So I will point out that when Derek was reading Dream Halls, he was like, oh, it affects either player. So, you know, we're normalizing a non-four player atmosphere.
I've given you now three examples of just like these weird old cards that like just had really warping effects on the game. Didn't really, and in my opinion, none of them were that healthy. Even if like Recurring Nightmare is like a really cool like top-down design. Like, none of these cards were, like, good for the game long-term. They all come with a lot of problems that are a lot more maybe nebulous on the surface, but, like, through gameplay and, like, constructed decks around them just, like, didn't really... If we kept making cards like Dream Halls, I don't know how this game would even look today. Yep. So I'm glad that we're not in that place.
What do you think about how the pitch elementals compare?
Well, the pitch elementals are, and I'll just touch briefly on this. Pitch elementals I'm very fond of because they encourage interactive gameplay. They are in of themselves interactive spells. So that bumps them up a lot for me. Now, you know, we can have a conversation about power level or whatever, and that's fine. But like, as designs, just having more interactive spells is like that are also kind of modal is like really, really cool. And I'm big on those. Yeah.
That's a good distinction. I buy that.
Okay. So now Derek wins a tournament with Dream Halls, goes to the JSS at Pro Tour New York 99. He goes 0-2 drop with his white weenie Cataclysm deck, goes to college, quits Magic, sells all his cards, and doesn't play Magic for 10 years.
What made you choose White Weenie after winning with an unfair deck that has nothing to do with creature combat?
Right, and I could play Necropotence or Living Death at that tournament, and I chose not to. I chose to play White Weenie with Imperial Armor and Cataclysm because I watched the Road to Nationals 1997 or 8 or whatever, that video where Matt Lindy won with a White Weenie deck. I literally chose it because I watched that video. And I was like, I'm going to get him with Sultari Priest. It was a horrible idea.
A noble idea.
I did it. Yeah, I showed up with it, you know? All right, so Derek comes back to Magic. The next four cards are going to be representative of that for me. So the first one is going to be Thoughtseize. Thoughtseize, for those of you who are living under a little rock, is a one mana black, one black mana sorcery that says, look at target player's hand, make them discard a non-land card from it, and you lose. Thoughtseize is probably my favorite Magic card, like, from a competitive standpoint. I absolutely love how powerful this card is when I'm trying to win the game. I love being able to fire it off on turn one and construct 5-6 turns ahead and know how I can play around everything that my opponent's trying. Mm-hmm. I love playing that kind of Magic. I like that its power scales down as the game goes on. If you're playing mid-range deck or a control deck, I like, you know, how you can force through things with combo decks like you see in Storm. I like that you can attack Storm or combo decks with this card. I like the life loss as a way to balance how powerful the effect is. I am a big proponent of cheap cards, so obviously one mana is at a ridiculous rate for this card. I do think this card is pushy as a Magic card. I think this is, like, you know, maybe a little too good, but, you know, its pedigree as a constructed powerhouse, multi-format all-star. A card, I love the original art so much. I have a foil Lorwyn Thoughtseize still in my cube. And I don't want to change it to the Time Spiral Remastered one or whatever. I just want the original printing. I'm in love with this card. It's almost a crutch to me from a competitive standpoint. Like, if I can play Thoughtseize, I feel safer. One more thing I'll say about it before y'all want to say anything about Thoughtseize is some people call discard or hand hate like Black's form of counter magic. And the distinction that I enjoy about hand disruption is that it is very proactive, whereas counter magic is reactive. As you'll hear me talk about, I really love when Magic is rewarding, you know, action. You know, and this is coming from somebody that played a lot of Magic in the 90s when that kind of stuff was, when you didn't have as many incentives for that kind of gameplay.
Yeah, I agree with many of the things you said, but there's one, like, I do like playing the card, but there's one thing that I do not like about it so much from a game designer standpoint, and that is that afterwards, you know, the coast is clear, that you can plan ahead so far. I feel like the degree that is fine, like if you have like Thoughtseize and maybe Inquisition or something like that in your cube, sometimes it happens and you will see the hand and can plan ahead. But in general, I think Magic is a better game when you have to guess what's in your opponent's hand and like play around the unknown. I think in general that makes for better gameplay. So we talked about it in the context of the Cataxian probe, right, on your stream recently. And that something that was previously hidden information becoming open information as a side effect of an already otherwise strong effect is something I'm not so super happy about.
That's fair. And, you know, to reiterate, I like Thoughtseize when I'm competitive, like when I'm trying to win, when I'm building a deck that's like, I'm going to a tournament setting. Yeah, I think like cards like Cataxian Probe, Thoughtseize, like giving you all that information is worth a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we've seen those cards scale up in mana value over time. You know, like we'll get the two mana, we'll get Check for Traps or Agonizing Remorse because of the power of casting it on one and following up with a threat. I do agree. I do think that hidden information makes Magic more fun, but I do also really like the gameplay of being disruptive and picking apart somebody's plan. So there's some tension there for sure. For me, when it's on balance, I do like having a little of that stuff available. And I do fully acknowledge, I think Thoughtseize is a very pushed map.
Yeah, it's good to feel the power. And it's also good to sometimes have that experience of knowing the hand. And like, it's good as part of Magic that sometimes this is something that happens. Not like generally against it, but that's just a minor gripe with this type of effect. And with Thoughtseize, it has so many more nice things about it than compared to the Cataxian Probe, which everybody could play. And yeah, I don't want to rant too much about it, but Thoughtseize, I think it's definitely worth it. And with Cataxian Probe, I think you're on the wrong side of the fence there.
Yeah. Probe is just trash. It's like, yeah, we don't have to go too much into Probe.
Junk food magic.
Okay, so going from Thoughtseize to my next one, which is Verdant Catacombs. So one of you joked about you could just put 8 lands in there because you know how much I love lands. I wasn't going to do that.
It's a spell book, after all.
Yeah, it's not a land book. Come on. What is this, a map? So I wanted to pick one. I chose Verdant Catacombs because I think the fetch lands are some of my favorite game pieces. A lot of like what my main cube is designed around are the power of fetch lands. So I've explored the design space from like a, you know, a cube standpoint, the implications of that. And I've really fallen in love with like how much they do for the game. I will 100% hear all arguments about shuffling and tutoring lands constantly. I understand the issues that are present with how they slow the game down, in paper especially. And that is a cost, and I acknowledge that. However, the fetch lands, what they do, it's all the little things that they do that make them so wonderful to play with. They're decision rich. They open up space within themselves, everything from filling up your graveyard faster, hitting threshold mechanics faster, being able to fix mana. And, you know, fixing mana is something that I'm very passionate about as a game designer. And as well as like Mishra's Bauble, Verdant Catacombs is like a really subtly powerful combination. And that's, I like the gameplay that exists there. I like being able to, you know, use Sylvan Library and then shuffle your library. I like the amount of manipulation that's present with Fetchland. Oh, and over time, it seems the more we see new cards that interact favorably with the graveyard, care about card type, are more demanding on our mana bases, all of those things just continue to make Fetchlands more desirable, but also just like generally more useful cards. And I'm willing to forego the game slowing down stuff in favor of like how much I can get out of those cards. Even like in my main cube, mm-hmm. like I have, you know, landfall creatures, like zoo creatures. And like, even just that, you know, when we talk about, you know, white one drops and red one drops, a lot of us refer to jackal pups. And I'm like, oh, what if they were all step lynxes? being able to manipulate cards power level, like even down to just landfall stuff, is just really lovely. It just, I can't come up with enough examples of cards that interact favorably with them and not come down on like the side of thinking that they're just great designs for especially Eternal Magic, like more powerful.
Yeah. So I've talked about it like in one of our previous episodes. We often talk about fetch lands, and I just feel like they are almost too powerful. Like it creeps me out a little bit. And in the pre-podcast chat, we touched slightly on the topic of mm-hmm. emblems, and I connected the two dots right now. Having a cube with fetch lands or with multiple duplicates of each fetch land, it really changes the environment almost as much as starting with an emblem.
Yes.
I understand, like, it's so cool to add something that is so lightweight in the general, like, you want these lands already anyway, you want good fixing. But then they also change so much else that it's kind of mind-boggling. And I'm not always 100% comfortable with that. Maybe one day I will also go there and lean heavily into the fetch lands like you do. But it really does change the match that is being played.
I agree.
Very, very interesting.
One follow-up I'll say, because I like what you said. And one thing I'll lay on top of that is that I think there's a huge movement in cube design where breaking singleton on lands, or just upping the quality of lands or number of lands, like mana fixing lands, is like something that has become very widely accepted by a lot of the community or a lot of designers. I think that that's great. Like we can go into that a little bit later. And I think that's a net positive. The more support that exists for people to be able to cast their spells, the more fun I think everyone is having. That's my perspective on it. However, your comment about what specialty cards like Fetchlands do to an environment, it can warp an environment. And I think that, like, I want to see more people when designing cubes with, you know, this current enthusiasm over breaking, you know, singleton on fetch lands, dual lands, and increasing that support as much as I've seen, that the cube architecture changes with that support. That's like something that I don't see enough of, because these cards are so powerful and so warping and create so many incentives. Sometimes don't see that line up with the rest of the list.
I just wanted to add, not only can they change the environment? Yes. They will. Like, it's almost impossible to have them not there shuffling and ending up in graveyards and everything. Double landfall, not interacting with the environment. And because they will do that, you should just think about how and, why not lean into
it? I agree. Next on the list is Liliana of the Veil. So when I played Magic in the old times, there were no such thing as Planeswalker. I came back to the game. I had no idea what Planeswalkers were. I started drafting limited. I think I played RTR, Gatecrash, and then what was the third one? The last in the RTR cycle?
Dragon's Maze?
Dragon's Maze, yeah. Did a draft of that, and I opened up Ral Zarek. I looked at the card. I'd never seen the card before. I'd never seen the card type. No idea. I just looked at it, and I just passed it along. And the person on my left looked at me like I had three heads. It was so funny. I very quickly learned how powerful they were and how dynamic they were. I saw some people playing standard or modern. It was one of those formats. And I saw Liliana of the Veil, and I fell deeply in love with that Magic card. I bought a playset of Liliana of the Veils very soon thereafter. And it was like one of the first cards I put money into when I started playing Magic again. I really love Jund and mid-range attrition-oriented gameplay. I've long played those decks in Standard and Modern and Pioneer. I really love supporting them in Cube. And Liliana is kind of not the platonic ideal of an attrition card, but it's pretty close to one. I love the color black, as I said before. I love the design of this card. It's very clean. It's very simple. It was a little pushed when it first came out. It was pretty powerful. And in 2023 standards, it's in standard now and people aren't necessarily all playing four copies, right? Like, it's not warping a constructed format anymore. Magic's kind of caught up and we've power crept through Liliana of the Veil, but it's not really so much the power level. It's interesting to me. I just love I love the gameplay of this card. I love Planeswalkers as a card type, and I'm not sure if I'm going to get booed out of the room with you two from saying something like that, but I'm pretty passionate about my love of Planeswalkers. I know that they haven't always gotten them right. We've seen, probably the top five most powerful Planeswalkers ever printed happen in the last 3 or 4 years, which is pretty insane. But, sure, you have your Minskin Boos and your Ren and Sixes and your Teferi Time Ravelers, but that's fine. You can have those. They're super powerful. Some people absolutely find them miserable to play against. People love them. I just love me a Liliana of the Veil. I just love me a little attrition game. Keeping the resources small, keeping the hands on lockdown. I'm just a total stan for Liliana.
Yeah. I mean, you're not getting boot out of the room, no way. I do enjoy playing with them. I think they're good for Magic. Sometimes I just think it's kind of weird that it's a card type that basically always has to be powerful, which is kind of weird, right? All other card types have everything from common to mythic rare, from trash to broken somehow. And the idea with Planeswalkers is that they start at powerful, and sometimes they accidentally drop into broken. With, I guess, for a long time, the only exception basically was Tybalt. And yeah, and then they made some uncommon ones later on, but it just, that's, I think, what I didn't like so much about them. They felt a little bit inorganic because they always had to be at a certain power level.
I think that's really well put.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't hate Planeswalkers or anything either. I'm also not going to boo you out of the room. If I boo you for anything, it's for only, picking the Verdant right so far for for the spellbook, or the seven other lands, Derek. But
they're implicit.
Yeah, no, I feel like kind of what you were describing, Yaakov, is a function of the fact that they can be answered by being attacked, right? Like, how many other card types exist where it's I can just get rid of this by taking a game action, which, I guess effectively you're giving your opponent life or something, or putting your board state in a bit more of a precarious position. But ultimately, if you have the resources, it's pretty free to attack Planeswalkers. And then to compensate for that, it seems that's kind of how they end up powerful a lot of the time. It's like, well, you don't just want to play a planeswalker and have it die. You want to have it protect itself. You want to have it do something really powerful. At least personally, the way I feel about them is like, I really like playing with trash. I love weak cards. Just based on the kind of environments I make, it's like really hard to find a place where it's like, oh yes, I can put a planeswalker into this and it's not going to be like the best card in the cube by a lot. Mm-hmm. For instance, like Jakob could talk about how with my my sci-fi cube, which was once upon a time the Star Wars cube, I very foolishly thought it would be a good idea to put like Dak and like 3-mana Duretti in there, and it was yucky.
I mean, they were even part of the inspiration for the cube, so you really tried.
Mistakes were made, but I would say like one of the latest projects I have been working on, my color shift, I am starting to head kind of the other way on the pendulum toward planeswalkers, thinking like, well, you know, if I'm going for kind of Boros controlling archetype, maybe I can fit that a Johnny Vengeance in there, you know?
Like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of environments where planeswalkers are just going to dominate all the board states that they come down on. I can absolutely see that. And I think cubes for like Magic Online oriented cubes, or sort of the way that people designed cubes, or what was available to us maybe 10, 15 years ago, planeswalkers were some of the best things that you could do if you were playing to the board, because they were easy to protect. Creatures were slightly worse. You know, there's a whole host of reasons for that. I guess I just like where they are now, which is that they just encourage everything that I want to happen in a game of Magic these days, which is just playing to the board, increasing the amount of interaction decisions that we both have to make every turn, and helping a game come to a conclusion faster. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess you could argue that, you know, we're gaining life because we have planeswalkers out. But, you know, they can just end the game. And I think that that's a net good thing for Magic. I also think that they're just like the perfect marketing tool ever of anything that they've ever come up with. So from a business standpoint, planeswalkers are also very good.
Yeah.
My question to you, follow up, is where do you sit on sagas? Like,
I think sagas are one of the best designed game pieces in the last 10 years. And I love them deeply. Their sweet spot really sits in limited. I think they're perfectly balanced for most modern limited environments. The one that kind of broke through was Fable. Fable is like, you know, as an outlier that I can point to, sees play in almost every format and Magic at this point. Kind of a really interesting card to talk about. I don't have to get into it too much, but I'll just try to keep it a little zoomed out. I adore them. Sagas, I mean. I think that the gameplay is perfect for most, yeah, like I said, most limited environments.
Yeah, they somehow are best way, the smartest way they found to organically fit a lot of text on cards.
Yeah.
They are so much, like, they have a lot of text, but they are easy to remember. And I don't know, they're a stroke of genius.
Well, yeah. Well, they're instructive, right? Like, the reason they can fit the text on there and have it be easy to onboard you to playing with them is because they tell you what to do. And you're reading it. It's like the whole like just physical engagement with the game piece is like really genius.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know, somehow they really nailed it with sagas. I'm not sure exactly what it is that went into it that made them so successful. But it was like right when I felt like they couldn't get better, you know, maybe Fable notwithstanding, then Read Ahead was introduced. And it's like, wow, like now there's some flexibility here, and like that's just awesome. Yeah,
Read Ahead is cool. I've definitely had some interesting conversations about Read Ahead. I got some pushback on it from a friend. Said that it was it added complexity to something that is good for gameplay, but harder to like. It's harder to for like newer players to like remember that or understand that they can do that. And it can create like decision paralysis for somebody if they're like newer to playing with them. Whereas like an original saga, one without Read Ahead, I guess, is just so prescriptive. It's so easy to like, you know, to engage with the card. And Read Ahead just adds like a layer of complexity that like for the three of us is fine. Like we're all very enfranchised Magic players. We enjoy having more decision-rich cards, you know, to play around with these days. it kind of muddies the water a little bit for like newer players.
I can see that.
How much you care about newer players is something that like isn't necessarily on everybody's plate, you know, especially when we're trying to get into the minutia of designing environment, custom environments. But it is a good data point to bring up, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's good to be like diplomatic and consider the other sides of the equation. I'm kind of surprised the direction that person, you know, was going didn't lead them to say something like, what happens when someone becomes used to playing sagas with read ahead and then they try to play, you know, one that doesn't have it on chapter two or whatever. And then, suddenly, because to me, that seems like, I don't know, if I were a new player, I could see myself thinking like, wait a second, like now I have to, you know, you're telling me that it's almost like, I want to say like split cards, like after fuse or something, right? Like, it's like, wait, but now I thought I got both halves of this. Like now you're telling me I have to, you know, I have to go back.
Sure. Like if the card was released as the other side, mm-hmm. as the other version of it and not just like a normal split card.
the old problem with the new wording, only this triggers only once per turn.
On what? On the read ahead? On read ahead?
No. I mean, on just triggered abilities, they often use the wording now that it only triggers once per turn. And because of that, everybody says, but this used to be all the time. Like, we don't like this new thing that's worse than before.
Those are, I think the once per turn is just a balancing knob. Like, hey, we can do
something. It's a good
one. It's a really good one because like you can do something more powerful, but have it balanced by only happening one. You know, it gives them a little flexibility.
I do think it's really easy to read it as annoying, though, because it's like you read it and I think what happens is like you see the potential of like what it could do if it didn't say that, but then it says mm-hmm. it. So
I made a meme about that finite where I said I had like the excited guy face. Oh, something cool on some cool activated ability and then a disappointed realization face. This ability only triggers once per turn.
Yeah.
But yeah, that sounds familiar.
Okay, so we have one more. Number 8 is the ultimate crutch for as I got back into constructed magic, especially as I started playing Legacy and Modern, is Abrupt Decay. Abrupt Decay is a black and a green for an instant. It says destroy target non-land permanent with mana value 3 or less, and it cannot be countered. Abrupt Decay was a card when it came out that I really like the card's design. I think it's great, but I leaned so hard on that card to like be able to just like scrap my way through games of Legacy. I squeezed every ounce of value out of that card that I possibly could have. And I felt scared playing those formats, eternal formats without that card in my after enough time. I needed it. I needed my Abrupt Decays. You know, what would happen if they resolved the Blood Moon? What would happen? Every answer, every card, it's okay. Just play an Abrupt Decay. We'll take care of it. This is obviously not, you know, holistically true, but in concept for me, especially at that time, save for something like True Name Nemesis, it just took care of all my problems. I relied on it greatly. And again, as a card design, I think it's great. I think it's good gameplay, good counteraction against reactive decks. Black-green being able to answer, you know, a bunch of different permanents is like very within its, you know, within what you can plausibly think of Golgari doing. So I love Abrupt Decay. And I love its neighbor Assassin's Trophy also for different.
As an Abrupt Decay enthusiast, I have to ask you, have you cast it on a Graveyard Trespasser yet?
I haven't, but I'm assuming the ward trigger goes off and then you don't have to discard the card.
Yeah. Yeah. You just decline. Yeah. It's pretty nice.
That's really nice.
Or you discard.
or you discard. Yeah. Which, you know, depending on what we're doing, could be a huge benefit.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I didn't think about that. Cool. Yeah. There's my spell book. I had a lot of fun putting this together.
Well, thanks for sharing. Yeah. I definitely feel like I learned a lot about you, both in terms of your history as a player, but also maybe some Golgari proclivities.
Yeah, I'm a Golgari man.
Nice.
Yeah.
There's one thing that you kind of left out, like what got you back into magic? Like, is it just a person or do you just see a card and feel like going to your card store next door and just pass some Razarex, or how did that happen?
The story is not too interesting. I you know, left college. I started entering the workforce and worked straight for about 9 years. And I got laid off from my job. Very first time I ever got laid off. Super depressed. Never got let down like that before. Always got the jobs I wanted. Finally got laid off. Spent the summer, you know, riding my bike around Brooklyn and generally enjoying being on unemployment. And then one day I thought about magic, just popped into my head. And I spent 2 straight days inside my apartment watching old magic coverage. So at that point, old magic coverage meant like I watched like the Players Championship and like some Pro Tour coverage. And I was like, wow, so different now. This is so cool. And then at the end of my 2 days, I like emerged from my room or whatever and looked up where
a new man.
like totally invigorated. Looked up where a local gaming store was. There was one in my neighborhood. So I was like, oh, I just need to go. So I looked up. There's a draft happening. Oh, I was terrible at draft. Well, let's just go. Let's go play. And I got on my bike, and as I'm riding down to the LGS, my DCI number pops into my head. It was so incredible. I hadn't thought about it in 10 years. And it just... And I was like, 737-407. Wow. There it is. Yeah. That was how I got back into it. And I spent that summer drafting. Whenever they had a draft, I would go and play for months.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was a really great format. Do you remember M14?
Oh, the opportunity draft format?
It was an awful draft format. But, you know, I'd start with whatever was given to me. So I played M14 for 3 straight months. A lot. I played a lot of Yeah, I did a lot of scroll thiefing and train condoring.
Yes.
And a lot of Advocate of the Beast and whatever the
red
the 4 mana 4/4 was, and the red one and like all that stuff was so fun to me.
Wasn't there like a white mythic that made angels for plants you controlled or something
you
like that?
Tap your creatures and they make angels. It costs like 8 mana.
I remember casting something like that.
Yeah. There was also like the unconditional sweeper. It was like, you know, remove. It was like a
planar cleansing.
Yeah, planar cleansing. Yeah, that was a rare in that format, I think.
Yeah.
That's how I got back in, and then I started playing, bought constructed cards, and then I went to like GP Richmond and played Birthing Pod. It was a modern tournament. I played Birthing Pod. Got destroyed. I think I went like 3-3 or 4-3 or something. I had a blast. You know, just having a blast losing is like when I know I'm at like peak having fun. You know,
for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
awesome. I don't even play constructed, but I would be happy to like sleep up a Birthing Pod deck around that era. I think, like, I don't know, that card's just always been really fun.
Same. Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing that we wanted to talk to you about was like things that get you inspired for cubes. And I mean, we heard a lot about your background now and that you like to play constructed magic. And I know it's been an inspiration for, I would call it your main cube, or at least the cube you went to KubeCon with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the origin story of that cube, how you started it, or like what got you into building that cube and how it works. Like we hinted at it when we talked about your spellbook, but I think there's more to that story.
Sure. That cube, the original version of that was... The inspiration for that cube, if I could trace it all the way back, was me and two of my kind of collaborators, like people that I've worked on this cube with, and also some other smaller projects. We saw the printing of the MDFCs in Zendikar Rising, and we all lost our minds. Like, I maintain that MDFCs are my favorite, if not my actual favorite, like my top three, along with sagas, for like innovations in magic design over the last like 10 years. We saw those cards and we freaked out, got really excited, and we put together a list that was focused on lands, like all utility lands. Because we said, these MDFCs are basically utility lands. So let's explore all the space that utility lands have to offer. And I think there was like a long list of cards you know, everything from like in white, like Windbriss Heights and Castle Ardenvale, I think it's called the white one, and all the MDFCs that were white, like Sajiri Shelter and Undo Inversion and the Emirius Call, and just like that for white, blue, black, like just all of them and all the lands. Every singleton mana fixing land that entered untapped, I think we had all of them. And it was just exploring this like mono mid-range space where like everything was just kind of like everything was kind of like a value attrition slash tempo kind of game plan, and we're just trying to find the limits of the design space that lands could provide. We worked on that for a while. I mean, I will say also Zendikar Rising, never have lost more money pre-ordering cards for a set in my life. I spent so much money on I mean, we were so excited by these cards. Like Seagate Stormcaller, that card, that mythic, it's like a 2/1 that lets you play it, and then your next instant sorcery spell that costs two or less gets you to fork it. I think I spent like almost $50 on that card in pre-order. I think you can buy it now for like a penny. I mean, I spent like $40 on like Nighthawk Scavenger, like the flying Tarmogoyf. Like we were, I mean, I was throwing money. I think my friends spent like $100 on a foil extended art Agadeem's Awakening. Like we were like, we were going insane. And it was, I mean, looking back, it's really funny. But we thought it was one of the most brilliant things we've ever seen that WotC do. So we started working on the cube. And at some point, you know, we're focusing on lands and where's the space get, where's the space continue to go? And it was either me or somebody else said, like, why don't we just make them all the lands duels so that we can play cards like Curd Ape and Days and Snuff Out? Because that kind of like is part of that space too.
Yep.
So then it's like, okay, so lands are starting to matter more and more and more. Eventually, we're starting to fill out space where mana fixing is the core mechanical design choice of the environment. And the mono mid-rangeness starts to bleed away, and it starts to cement to specific gameplay speed, different archetypes.
Yeah.
And
somebody said Curd Ape.
And yeah. All of a sudden, it's like, all of a sudden, it's like, whoa. Steplinks is just literally a 1-mana 4/5 if we have a ton of fetch lands. And then we start scouring MTG Top 8 and looking at all the constructed quality cards that would go into these decks historically, and we're like focusing on what we might have missed based on, or like what the gameplay patterns were based on these constructed decks in throughout Magic's history. Like, what are all the Zoo decks that have existed? What did they look like? What cards do they share in common? How does this whole architecture of this work? And, you know, soon it started to become about focusing in on like making it feel, focusing so much on rate that it started to just feel like we want it. Like we basically decided that we're just trying to make a cube that plays like constructed Magic, that our primary focus is just on efficiency, and like we just kept pushing the power upward in that direction.
It's super interesting that what now from the outside feels like the main inspiration is just something that, because of your interests and preferences, just slid itself like made its way into the center of that cube. Very interesting.
Yeah. And well, all three of us that were working on the space, we're huge constructed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's why it worked also, is we shared all of that passion for like the other two guys were like really into vintage, and I really like legacy and modern, and whatever. We had like a shared love of that. Over time, I think the next evolution was we have to start building synergy into the cube, because we just became so concerned with rate that there was just no synergy. There was nothing really synergistic happening. We had this joke that was kind of half serious, half joking, which is called good card synergy, which is when we'd argue about why there was no synergy in the cube, we would say something like, well, you see, when you cast Collector Brutality and you escalate by discarding the Lingering Souls, you're just playing two good cards together and they happen to have synergy with each other. And that was like our joke about it. And at some point, you know, we had like a long conversation about how synergy plays a role in the cube, and that these sort of like critical mass approaches to putting archetypes in the environment, you know, like humans, for example, was in my cube for a long time. How like you can overwhelm these attrition strategies by going bigger, basically. So there's a concept that I work a lot with that Sam Black kind of popularized called small game, big game. It's a really wonderful article that Sam wrote for Star City, I think, where Sam explains the difference between an Elvish Visionary and whatever the card is that makes you discard a card when it enters the battlefield, like a Burglar Wraths. What kind of gameplay both of those encourage, how strategically decks can be built to encourage small game or big game, and small game being something that is on the attrition tempo axis where you're trying to keep the game small. Like control is the hallmark attrition deck because it's just trying to keep the game very, very small. And tempo is kind of on the other axis of that where it's using mana exchanges to try to, you know, keep the game very small. And then like ramp is an example of a big game deck. A tribal deck like humans is a big game deck. It's trying to break out of that small game, you know, stranglehold and overwhelm the opponent with the board state. There's a really great tension between those two that you can lean into when you're choosing archetypes. So a lot of synergy decks I looked at from this big game standpoint where you're trying to, you know, invalidate attrition, and that dynamic sort of seeded or helped see the foundation for a lot of how I was going about building synergistic decks.
Okay, so I have a question about that. I feel like this small game and big game thing is something that's just pretty natural to the to Magic's nature.
Yes,
that doesn't make much sense the way I said it, but like
it is.
It's inherent in Magic.
Yes,
I feel like.
Yes, but it's a so, yes, but it's a framework that you can use to kind of describe it. Anyway, sorry, continue.
So, and you felt like even though it's pretty ingrained in Magic, it was still missing from your cube at that point?
Yeah, but just because because we had done a lot of work, we overemphasized and maybe just loved attrition and tempo so much. We, for a time, we were arguing that there can never be a big game if the small game is good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so if everything is just small game, that's fine because the existence of a big game strategy will just get stifled by all the pressure that the small game decks are putting on it. This didn't end up being true, but it was something that we believed at the time. If you look at Delver as a great example of a tempo-based deck. Tempo, if you like my generic definition, is, because you know this is a very lovely topic that people like to touch on in Magic discourse. Tempo, or Delver as a strategy, is a mid-range deck that is blue. That is a blue approach to attrition, which is using exchanges like Counter Magic to press its advantage or to keep the game small. Not everybody agrees with me when I say Delver is mid-range, but I'm pretty confident that I'm right in that instance. But like we envisioned basically like Delver and Jund being basically the entire format. And if you max out on the power level of those decks, then you can, then decks that are trying to achieve critical mass, like let's just say a humans deck that needs lords or whatever, that it'll never be able to break through the level of attrition that we're supporting in the cube. This was, I think, an oversight by me and my fellow designers, because once we started putting it in, we realized how much better cube played out and how much more dynamic the cube was. I mean, one of the main bits of feedback I got was that a lot of cards felt the same, which they were, but like my approach was like, well, Izzet Charm and Drawn in the Lock are very different cards, so they should encourage different kinds of gameplay. And they're like, well, that's true that they're different, but they are kind of like the same kind of card in the context of the cube.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to argue for the nuance of it. The drafters just gave me a lot of great feedback telling me you have to zoom out, you know?
Yeah, I think this in-between state you just talked about is really interesting to me. Just having an environment that basically only has one type of deck, because in my head, like every cube is like a closed environment. Like it stands on itself. And there are just some forces in games that will push one deck towards having to play the bigger game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, you basically found out that if you really push all cards in that direction, it does not like fix itself in a way.
Right. Yeah.
That's a very, very interesting lesson, I think. Like,
yeah, I think so. Also, like the over-reliance of rate as the primary form of card evaluation was perhaps overemphasized. Rate is very important, but it's not the overriding factor to everything. Like rate and synergy are, you know, often at odds with each other in Magic. And if you just go hard in one direction, the game play becomes homogenous given a long enough timeline. Mm-hmm. It took a little bit of time, but we did kind of come to that conclusion.
I really just like just going into like making something so insular to really like be at the point where you can figure this stuff out. It's really cool.
Yeah. It's fun. I mean, this process was really fun and really hard and like taught me a lot of like just things about game design. I'm not even sure I could call them fundamentals because I don't know a lot about game design, but like led me down a path that taught me some things that I, you know, just still apply to this day. So I guess after that, we started breaking Singleton on threats. And this is where all of us, three of us diverged completely. So we started talking about how much we loved cards like a card like Stoneforge Mystic and how disappointed we are that there's not another version of it. Like Relic Seeker is probably the closest, and that card just sucks. it's fine, but it's like just not good enough for like what this cube is trying to do. I just wish there was another kind of Stoneforge. That's when we just said, well, let's just play two. And then that broke the seal on a lot of space opening up and also caused a lot of disagreements between the three of us. And this was nice because then we got to all design our own versions of the cube, mm-hmm. where we all had different philosophies by which we were breaking Singleton on cards. And so like I said before, getting multiples on lands is kind of very digestible to people these days, but breaking on threats is still weird outside of exactly Delver of Secret. Because like a lot of people love just putting three copies of it in their cube or whatever, because they're just trying to make the card functional or the deck that it wants it functional.
Yeah, that was like very special in that regard.
Yeah.
Probably because it was such a good deck in Constructed and because it was always so trash talked about in Retail Limited that people say, it has to be possible to do this in cube.
Yeah, and there's a lot of like memes about like people putting Delver in their cubes and like just how anemic the card is. Basically, we all came up with our own restrictions for breaking single. One guy said, I just want to play as many copies of the cards I want to play. Just like literally unbounded. Just what's the justification? Because the cards are good and I want to play them. And, you know, I want to play four copies of Brainstorm. I want to play four copies of Thoughtseize. I want to play four copies of blah, 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 blah. Swords to Plowshares and all this. And it's like, okay, well, I don't, you know, really see a need for that. From a design standpoint, like, yes, they're all powerful in, you know, with Swords of Plowshares. Like, it's true unconditional removal 99.9% of the time. But I just didn't see, like, a reason for it other than you just wanted to play more copies because it's just better, you know, than, like, more expensive versions or other versions of the same mana value. And then, so I kind of spun off and said, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to play threats that aren't replaceable and that you are like my signposts that you can build decks around.
Yep.
And I started out with a lot of them. I think I had like 13 of them once I started doing it.
I think that's the first to the point where I first saw the cube.
Yeah, I think that was in four packs of Magic. The cube that I brought to CubeCon had, I think, 12 or 13 different Singleton breaks on actual non-land cards.
Yeah.
And I tried to come up with a reason why. And some of them were a lot more tested than others, but I was like, you know, fuck it. Let's just do it. Let's just try all of this stuff and see what happens. I got some testing in. It wasn't to the satisfaction that I would want. So after CubeCon, I decided to cut it way down because some of it just wasn't as necessary. Regardless of how well it worked in the cube, it wasn't. It basically muddied things a little bit. And people were starting to ask for a signifier, like a sticker on the card that I had two copies of because they couldn't remember, because they couldn't remember and they wanted to know. And I didn't like that, but like, it was kind of going into that place with regards to the way people were engaging. So I consulted with a bunch of people. David McDarby was like a huge help with this. And he said, just make it one per color and that's it. Just do one for each color, one multicolor, one color, call it a day. And I think I have right now, I think I have exactly seven. Yeah, I have exactly seven.
Which is the multicolor one?
Wild Nakato.
Yeah. Sure, I like it.
Yeah. So right now the breaks are Stoneforge Mystic, Delver of Secrets, Death's Shadow, Arclight Phoenix, Collected Company, Wild Nakatl, and Urza's Saga. Yeah, I think that pretty much covers it.
Really, really cool story. Like, it's a lot of things that you can learn from that, I think. And especially that you just did a few things just because and went there and learned something from it. And you got good feedback. I mean, the sticker thing wasn't necessarily meant as criticism or feedback in that way. It was just something people were interested in, but you went like a step further and thought about what does it actually mean and what's the underlying problem there. And yeah, like just build your cubes and make the mistakes. And then you find a lot of things out, like how to improve it. Nice.
Absolutely. Very nice. I'm a very, very big proponent of testing and iteration and refinement is the part of cube design that I have grown to really love. I'm not like as passionate about making cubes as a thought exercise. I think the exploration of an idea and discovering what's working and not working and refining it is what takes more time, more effort, and is more rewarding for me.
I mean, they're both kind of like related. You just have to go to the step where you actually play it.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that don't play their cubes. A lot of people. Or they'll play it like once a year.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they're wrong.
Because it can be intimidating. I don't know. Max asked me like a few months ago if we shouldn't play my pyramid cube again. And I looked at that list and said, do people really want to play with these trash cards? And we played it a few times and people had fun. So it was good. And like, I keep iterating there, but sometimes you have to like just try it again. And sometimes I'm sometimes a little bit afraid of my own creations.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's also just, there's a level of vulnerability sometimes, especially if it's, you know, if it feels personal at all. So a lot of, I think there's an emotional part of it and that gets.
Yep.
That gets
absolutely. I feel like that's something I've been aware of for a while, not just like as a person who makes like goofy cubes and stuff, but also as someone who like interacts with other people a lot. I don't know. I try to pay close attention to how people are responding to things and how people feel about things. And it's like, it seems like there's a really high like correlation between somebody giving like harsh kind of feedback on someone's cube, saying something that is definitely critical, and like the other person like being hurt or like kind of retreating, or you know, just feeling like bad basically. And I don't know, it's sad because like I feel like that kind of thing really like gets in the way of the process itself, right? Because like cube can be like such a fun like creative outlet and like I don't know, place to explore with your friends. And yeah, I don't know, it's like somehow I don't think it's like on one side or the other necessarily. Like I wouldn't say the problem is like, you know, people should never give criticism or like people should never be sensitive, but like maybe just slightly greater awareness on the parts of like each side would probably like benefit people a lot.
I could not agree more with you. And I think about this a lot. When I got back from MagicCon Philly, I wrote this like long Twitter post about some takeaways I had. Basically, the way I think about it now is actual feedback is really hard to do, both from the person giving it and the person asking for it. Like the whole thing is like really messy and like doesn't end well most of the time, and is often like riddled with miscommunication or using different words to try to explain similar things that are then misinterpreted. There's a whole lot of issues that come about when people ask for feedback on a cube. And so what I've been working on suggesting to people is, as a designer, don't ask for like actual feedback. Like, have focused things you're asking about, because if you just ask for general feedback, the conversation will devolve into something that you don't want it to be pretty quickly. And like controlling that conversation is really hard and might not even be rewarding, because a lot of times we're hearing, okay, this is what somebody's saying, so what do they actually mean? And how do I take that back? How do I take that with? So as a simpler way, especially in casual settings, in groups of people that don't necessarily know each other, and as Cube is growing as a format or like a way to play Magic, my suggestion has been just point out the things that you liked about the Cube. Point out the things that you thought were fun. Encourage the person who's showcasing their environment to think about what people are having fun doing in your cube and what people are responding positively, because like those are all like easy things to be actionable about as a drafter, you know, like, oh, I liked the speed of your format. I think that's really cool. Or like, wow, the drafting part of it was really fun because I got to do this. It encourages the designers to think about what is fun about their environment and to lean further in it. It's all positive. It stops people from criticizing each other, and it keeps communication easy.
Yeah.
Also, like on a more cynical note, so let me put a period on that. So that's how I'm suggesting people do it. I'm not expecting to get adopted, but like this is just kind of where my head is at now. So stick that in your brain for the rest of the conversation. And then on a more cynical note, I actually don't think people want to hear actual because that's hard.
Yeah.
Actual feedback is like a lot less personal and a lot more about just like design principles and like, you know, ass fans and like just hypergeometric calculations and like, just like all these different things that like are less about fun and more about like, you know, how hard are we trying to optimize here? How hard are we going for these goals? And they can be harsh. It's not about it being personal anymore. It's about like, you're trying to design a game. Here's real game feedback. And I don't think a lot of people want to hear that. I think people want to hear happy things.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense, because while it might be much harder to, from the positive things, to lean into that, to know what to do to lean into that, as you said, it is much easier to take it. And like this, like more concrete, also negative feedback might get you to a point quicker, but we're doing this as a hobby and we have no need to get there quicker.
Right.
Like it's fine to just be polite and focus on the positive things, and that still helps, and the progress might be slower, but there's no bottom line like chasing us, because we're just cube designers for fun and not game designers as our like
our job,
main income. Yeah, as our job.
Like, I'm not a professional, I just do this, you know, we're just all just doing this for fun, you know.
Yeah, so we don't have to take the bad parts of feedback.
You don't have to offer it, you know, but like, yeah. It is really good to have people that you can have those conversations. Having trusted people that you know you can build something together.
Close friends.
Yeah. People that you know, you trust their opinion, you know? But like soliciting that kind of conversation from somebody you don't know, that's not often going to be a productive conversation.
I feel like at the beginning you guys were talking and it was like, you know, I agree with some of what you're saying, and like I have like some tweaks or, you know, things that I disagree on slightly, and then like up to now it's like, well, now I feel like you nailed it and I've almost like nothing to add. I guess like one of my thoughts is, yeah, it really matters like to what extent you know the person. And even if you like think you know someone, do you know them in this context? Like, do you know what their relationship is like to the cube, or like, you know, it doesn't have to be cube, to whatever it is, like to the game of Magic, or like can even be things outside the scope of Magic, believe it or not. Like, yeah, if you're giving somebody feedback in general, it's like, are you sure that they want that? Because a lot of the time, yeah, they probably don't, like you said, Derek. I think it's interesting too, like I feel like I can really tend to find myself trapped in like an urgent like frame of mind, like things need to change quickly. Like and like one of the things too, like this is still like contained within the Magic world, is, you know, every now and then I'll think like, Like, what if I start trying to do some coaching or like something like that? Like, what if, you know, what if it's something I consider offering, like just as like a, you know, let's see if anybody is even interested or cares or whatever. And part of the reason I'm thinking that is like, because I know at least, you know, some people, like at least one person specifically is interested in that kind of thing for me. But then I think about like, mm-hmm. you know, the rest of like the potential people who could be interested in it. And I realize like, wait a second, I have no evidence of that. Like I'm trying to impose like what I, you know, what I think needs to happen onto them. I'm not actually like, you know, I'm really not thinking it through from their perspective. And it is, yeah, I guess, like you said, Jakob, like everybody is like, you know, doing their own thing. This is a hobby. It's supposed to be fun. Not everybody has to be trying to like optimize things or trying to learn things. Like it's okay to like mess around and have fun. And I don't know. I think there are a lot of places in Magic where people forget that. And that like competitive frame of mind is like, I don't know, it's at the forefront. It's like the most respectable way to play the game or something. So I don't know.
I mean, it's a really cool way to play the game, but it's not for everybody. And there's so much else there, right? Like there's people that feel the need to improve very quickly because they do want playing Magic to be their job. And you see these people, like they are very visible. But for us as cube designers,
yeah.
that is much less.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like ultimately, you know, we are not wizards, right? Like kind of what I took from some of what you were saying, Derek, is like we don't have like profits on the line, right? Depending on like, you know, our ASBANs and things like that. So ultimately, like we get to try to work on the cubes in the ways that we want to. And yeah, that means like it's not necessarily going to be optimized or it might take longer to get there or something like that, or it might never get there. And yeah, like that's okay.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the like the pleasure space that I, you know, enjoy being in as a part of this like tiny little part of the Magic community, you know?
For sure.
Kind of where a lot of conversation about criticism about cubes and stuff tends to go is like people just want to be told that they're clever and their cube idea is great and like, you know, everything, and there's look how beautiful my pretty little creation is, you know?
And rightfully so, like in all of them there are good ideas there.
Yeah,
generous, but sure.
Yeah, but that, I don't want this to turn into a you know, tearing people down fest, because I like you know, like telling people that they're idiots or whatever because they can't take, you know, real criticism. Like it's not like the energy that I want to bring into this, but I just think that like maybe some people hold their cubes a little too close to their heart.
Yeah, I would say it's really easy to end up doing something like that. Yeah. Especially just like given like the, I don't know, thinking like psychologically about like the mere exposure effect, like the amount of time that you spend thinking about a cube, working on a cube, like that has to be related to what you think of it, how much you like it.
Yeah. Also, just designing games is hard, and like yeah. that's okay, you know? Like the experience of designing my main cube with two other people, the majority of its lifespan, was one of the most beneficial things I've done with regards to designing a cube and or any cube. So I really strongly encourage anybody to not think about to consider the possibility that two or three brains is so much better than. This is a, you know, a related topic of like, you know, people holding things too close to their chest, where it's, you know, one person, a singular person's idea can be a little too precious, you know, and having trusted friends to balance your ideas off of, to work together. I mean, this is literally what Wizards of the Coast does, and they make sets. Like, why are you taking on all of this work as a singular person?
It goes even further. When people win the Magic World Championship, they get their face on the card,
yeah.
and they are not even allowed to, from scratch, completely design the card.
With good reason.
And yes, yes. And it's just one card,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
From a clearly highly skilled player. That's how hard it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really funny. Just thinking about like the kind of implied like lack of trust or something with the with that. But like, yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Kind of one more thought that I'd been holding on to, which is I think if somebody asks you for feedback, or if you're thinking about giving feedback to someone, generally like a good baseline is at least to like think of something positive to say. It doesn't have to be the main thing that you were thinking about or experiencing like during the draft or whatever, but it's, I think it's pretty important to at least have something like that up your sleeve. And then from there, you can kind of think about, well, okay, how well do I know this person? Do they seem to be reacting like, you know, I said this positive thing to them and that's what they wanted to hear and that's that? Or is it like, no, they actually want to hear something else, something they can turn into like a takeaway or, you know, use to iterate? And that's, I think, where it probably makes sense to start thinking like, well, okay, you know, I paid you the compliment. Now it's time to give you some constructive feedback as well.
Sure. I think setting expectations is really in communication over this stuff. Like anecdotally, when I was testing for KubeCon, I wrote out a kind of like a little speech about like my setting expectations with my drafters. And well, first of all, I was scheduling the event as, hey, this is KubeCon playtesting. And I have some goals in playtesting. And I reiterated them when we sat down. And it was something to the effect of like, hey, I want you all to help me playtest this cube. So what we're going to do is do a focused playtest. So all of you are going to sit down and I want you to all try to win. Come in with this mentality. Like, no matter what that means to you, I don't care what it means to you. I want you to interpret the cube in a way that you're like, I'm gonna do this because I think it gives me the best chance to win. And then after the draft, I'm gonna ask everybody some questions. And so everyone did their thing. And then afterward, I would, you know, I had these pre-prepared questions of like, okay, so now I'm gonna ask you some questions. Question number one, where was the fun in the experience for you out of everything? And people would talk. And then it would start to get derailed and I had to bring it back. And like, I had to keep the conversation focused on the same thing. Cause like, you know, it invariably would go to something else or someone start complaining about something or blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, let's just answer the question. And now let's go to the next question. It's like, what did you think about, you know, what did you blah, blah, blah. Just like, what did you like about this? Can you talk more about that? And just making sure that everything was really tight and really focused. And then I like get all this data from and reactions from drafters, and I have to sit with all of it and say, okay, this is what they all said to me. Now, what does this all actually mean? And what adjustments should I make based on what I am interpreting from all of them saying, communicating this stuff? And that's, you know, this was like a spirited process in favor of trying to make this cube tuned in a way that was fun to play and felt competitive for people that were playing it at KubeCon. So it's like I was setting expectations with everybody from the get and making it a good experience for them to like sit down, play, think about it, communicate. And then, you know, that was like a fun process. But like, I instead of just soliciting general responses, I'm like there in trying to make my cube better, trying to get as focused of a conversation as possible. And that's just, this is hard, man. Like this is not something that you do unless like I want this thing to be, you know, more driven towards its goals. Like it's aspirational gameplay.
Yep. I wanted to say too that just I feel like from a Chaos Cube draft or two that I've done, you know, with you, I was really impressed by like the level of thought that you put into your questions. Like it, for me as a player, but also as like a cube designer, it was like, where does he even like start like to to think of this stuff? Like, where does it come from? I don't know.
I don't know, man. I guess as I'm just trying to figure out my own approach to designing these. And I know that people like talking about things that they like. So it's, I don't really know what else to say besides I like doing this stuff. I think it's fun.
Yeah.
This is why all of this works, podcasts and so on, right? We just like talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Did either of you read the initial ideation article that I sent? The Mark Rosewater one?
Yes.
I took a lot of inspiration from this article.
Yes. I did not read, like, it's in a series. I did not read all of the other articles, but I was a little bit surprised that it comes at number 14 in this series. But because, I mean, it's really where you start, right?
I think so. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Like, why you are building this cube on, in that case, that set. The initial questions that you either ask yourself or that you will, some of them you will just have to stumble upon. Like, there's sometimes no way past some of these steps.
So Mark Rosewater did a podcast in tandem with this article, and I loved it. Like I said before, I took a lot of inspiration from this process. And one thing that he said that I keep coming back to, that I use when I'm working on anything in the cube space, which is like the set. He keeps using set because, you know, he's talking about just limited sets or whatever. Let the set become what it wants to be. And that's a really loaded statement with a lot of implications. And perhaps the most important one, you have these ideas for what the cube is or what you want it to be. But as you play it and as drafters come back and talk about it and you see the decks and you see what's working and what's not working, the cube needs something. Like, you're going to see what it wants, how you have to change it. It's similar and perhaps in the way that people make a work of art, or some people might find this process useful in making art, is like, it's going to find its own form. It's going to tell you what it needs when it's being played or as you're going through these, to further defining the idea.
Yeah.
Letting the cube kind of like play out and communicate that to you is something that like I am try to be very sensitive to, and is something I really enjoy thinking about, because it's a really juicy, substantial concept, like that this cube is going to like tell you what it needs. Like, the decks are going to tell you what they need for themselves, and that the ego of the individual, the designer, should not get in the way. Like, you should be doing things in favor of the cube, right? Because the cube has its own goals, and those goals might change. They might become more defined in one way or another. You can almost see it as like this living thing that's trying to become itself.
Well, you can say it like that, or you can say that you shouldn't overthink things and sometimes trust your feelings in game design.
Sure.
This is in a way like the less like making the cube like into a creature with its mind, but it's also about trusting yourself.
Sure, I'll take both answers. Yes.
Yeah, I mean it's both the same, it's like same thing, but like formulated a little bit differently, I would say.
Yes.
And with this article, we'll link it. It starts at the start, like it's a thing about the start of a project, basically. But what you just talked about is something that you keep coming back to, right?
Yeah, it just had a pretty big impact on the way I like help define what it is I'm trying to make. Well, like, and all the thing, the different points comes up, you know, top down, bottom up, how we prioritize the ideas within a cube, what the process of exploring design spaces, the goals with playtesting and iteration, being smart about feedback, like. I look at this and I'm like, okay, this is a glimpse into perhaps how they work. Can I apply this in any way, in the most amateur way possible, to my own process? And so I develop a perspective over it, you know? This is getting pretty granular. I like it, this conversation. I saw in the show notes, I'm not sure how much more time I have with you guys, but I saw in the show notes you wanted to maybe mention the bar cube a little bit.
I was there when you were talking on stream about the initiation of the cube, and yeah, maybe you should quickly retell that again, and then where it went and what state it is in right now. Because I think it's a really cool initial idea. I don't even know how to pronounce the word in Maro's article. The ideation?
Yeah,
that is a really good example for that. And yeah, I wonder where it went.
The inspiring idea behind the bar cube was to make a cube that I can carry around in my pocket. That was it. That was like my, what if I could make a cube that I could just carry around with me in my coat, or in like actually initially thought of it as like putting it inside my pocket and like in my concept. And like, what does that even look like? And is it possible? And so I decided to figure out the mechanical restrictions that would be at play there.
Loaded restriction, as we figured out.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because once you go into it and say, I'm not going to play with sleeves, that's fine. You know, it's a little limiting. You can't play with double face cards, but no sleeves. No tokens, that's pretty big. And no counters, that's also really big.
Counters as in dice, not as in counterspell.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, once you're in for all that, there's a lot of stuff that's cut out, but you can better define what you're looking for. I'll very quickly say this. I think that restrictions and restraint is something that like breeds creativity or whatever the platitude is. Like, I'm all about that. I think like setting those boundaries for yourself can like open up a lot of ideas. And like, I think there's a pretty good example of how that manifests itself in terms of designing an environment. My restrictions were, I can't have extraneous game pieces because if I'm bringing something in my pocket, I can't fit much more than the cube in there. If I'm bringing something to a bar, I don't want to have to like drop a dice on the floor and not be able to find it. I don't want someone to bang the table and the dice counter spins around and nobody knows what number it was at because we're all drunk. You know, just like, it's like literally like practicality for like carrying it and then like easy cleanup, easy setup, just very simple things.
Yep. But it's really loaded, like...
It's really loaded, yeah. And I decided if that's what it's going to be, it should be scrappy, limited gameplay. Like, just give me creatures, let's do creature combat, let's do creature abilities, good keywords, like activated abilities, things like adventure was like way up on my list. Just stuff like that. Like that we can, you know, it's not hard to track because if you're getting drunk, you don't want to like have too much of a mental overload. You want things to be relatively fast, easy to draft, and fun, proactive, and like, you know, combat-y. Initially, my first list had a lot of uncards in it and a lot of playtest cards because I wanted it to, I was like, ooh, this is a good space for me to do that. And I put the list together and bought all the cards, and I very quickly found that like a lot of these playtest cards were either, and like uncards were like ridiculously overpowered or like nobody wanted to play them. Like, Animate Library was the best card in the cube.
Well, that's just like there's a Strixhaven card, right? It's like the same thing.
Yeah, fractal something.
Like Body of Research. Hold on.
Yeah, I think it's actually called Body of Research.
Yeah, you might be a thing. Okay, anyway,
it's it is. It's a stupid card. Yeah, that's it. But it's a mythic too. It's funny. Oh, and then obviously the errata. So I don't exactly remember how I came to this like logical conclusion for this, but I think it was, if I'm taking away all of this stuff, all of my like design space and magic to make this work, I need something for people to care about. And somehow when I thought about Learn Lesson from Strixhaven, I just remember loving the way that it played and loving how that it made me care about my draft. Like, it made me think about my draft differently. Yeah. And I was like, wouldn't it be cool to just like have that as part of the experience, just to make the draft more interesting so that we're caring about something else.
Yeah, but then you bump into your other restriction. Like, the way it works in Strixhaven is that basically the most important like lessons are talk creators, and you don't want those.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I thought sciences was the most important one, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, but yeah, because that was just one card compared to the other. Yes, that was the most valuable one.
Yeah,
sure.
But yeah, and then it's like, oh, I can't play Silver Quill Summoning or whatever it might be called. The one that puts like an inky, the 2/1 flyer into play, the token, because I can't play tokens. So I'm like, okay, well, we'll figure it out. And I have these like lessons that are like, oh, we're not going to play this in the main deck, but like maybe it'll be good for the sideboard. And I picked some ones that were like mediocre or super powerful, you know, and so I hit up my friends and I was like, let's go to the bar and let's just play this a bunch. And I just want to get some, you know, they're all three of these guys are friends of mine. They're all game designers and they gave me some really good feedback. And one of them had this brilliant idea of taking the hybrid creatures from like these like shitty hybrid creatures and like just making them into the lessons. He's like, because if you can't do tokens, but you want creatures to get, just do that. And I was like, this is perfect. And so it was that we started down that path. And I cut all the uncards and I cut all the playtest cards except for one, which is Growth Charm. It's still in there.
But I got your giant growth in there.
Yeah. There it is.
Yeah, but that is also something where you now, your original idea not only restricts you, but it opens up some other space. Because it's a very casual environment and you're playing with physical cards, you get the chance to just sharpie on that this is a lesson. Like, it's a low value card, like you didn't spend much money on it, so just writing on it that it is a lesson just works out well. It wouldn't work, for example, for Finite and I when we create something that we want to play on Magic Online. But yeah, you just thought about your restriction again, and or your friends did together with you, and you found a nice solution that opened up there.
Yeah,
very cool.
Yeah, and you know, again, it's I need people to work with on this, you know. I much prefer it. Just getting that good feedback from trusted people, you know, trying to make it better. I mean, there are little things I've changed, but like I, you know, noticed how the drafts would play out, like how the card pool would be broken up and what kind of decks people would build that and what they thought was fun. And I've just been like moving cards in and out of it ever since. And I've gotten a ton of playtest with this. Like, I bring it to an SCG, I brought it to MagicCon, and it just gets jammed all the time. Like, if we're just waiting for people to cube with, we just start playing it. And you know, we'll draft it, play one match, and then it's it. We just get thrown back in the bag. And I love that. I think that's super appropriate.
I'm gonna repeat myself because I have nothing better to think of. It's the fast food of cube, Derek.
Yeah. Hell yeah. I like that. It's my fast food cube.
I mean, like, it's very like practical. It's awesome because I feel like a lot of the time people have ideas about things like that and they don't translate very well to like real world experience. But it sounds like this is like really a success, like practically for you.
Yes. And very surprisingly, it had a huge ripple effect through the cube. I was not expecting that. I mean, this was like my ultimate pet project, but the idea was so grokkable to people.
Yeah, it's very resonant.
That it hit pretty hard, and I've had a bunch of people clone it and build it. Somebody tagged me yesterday in a Discord. They're like, "Hey, I built your cube. Well, here's a pack one, pick one." And I was like, you know, I can't help but smile at that shit, man. Like, that's awesome. Like, I never ever thought that was going to happen to me at all. It means a lot. So that's great. I'm super stoked.
Yeah,
on that.
We will link both of your cubes because, especially because this one is like super easy to clone. Like, getting it in paper is very affordable, right?
Yeah, it's like $20 or something to like.
I don't know. Is it that easy? Because you have to have like the lesson learned written on the stuff. And personally, I feel like if I don't have my stuff like signed by Derek himself, like, is it really, you know, a
actually,
I mean, that's the premium version.
Actually, the premium version, yeah. That's, so you have to pay for Discord access for that. The ultimate, this is the private. So one thing that going forward with BarCube is that, like, I'm just gonna update it every couple months, like 20 to 30 cards.
Yeah, keeping it fresh.
Yeah, because like it gets a lot of reps, and like it's 180 cards, not big, and the gameplay is very straightforward, and so like it. There's so many ways you can build something like this that it makes perfect sense to just keep changing it for the sake of refreshing the experience. So that's kind of my plan with it. I'm also trying to conceptualize what an old border only version of this would be. So one of the main pieces of joy that this cube brings to people is playing cards without sleeves. Because it feels like you're a kid again or like you're new to magic. And like that hits people pretty hard. And so my next step with it was, you know, I started playing magic in 1994. So what if I built a version of this that all the cards were from Beta, Arabian Nights, Antiquities, and Legends, and just made it like really old school and really scrappy. Like I'm actually like, I started putting it together and I was like, first of all, this is going to be a shit mess. Like, it's just going to be horrible. And second of all, there's all this stuff that exists in those sets that I can't use for the sake of like complexity. Like, I don't want to put banding in this cube, but like, but I might have to. And then like,
I mean, if you play with us, then banding's not a
problem. Yeah, exactly. But if like, If it's just like, oh, I, you know, here's a little, a barcube, but it's got like a beta grizzly bears and hill giant and like desert twister and unholy strength and disenchant and clay statue. Like, that sounds awesome. First of all, it's going to cost me a fucking fortune. Second of all, you know, it'd have to be play tested. So God help me if like these cards suck or like it's not a fun environment. So like, I don't know what to do. I need to kind of like see how this looks, you know?
Yeah.
But a format, a bar cube where I can literally like attack with like grizzly bears and stuff is like, that's
like a dream come true.
Yeah.
It's just, it's very, very hard to do. It's just, I mean, that's part of why these cards are so expensive now. Like, they got rarer and people with now have money, like, remember the things, the toys they had when they were younger. And then saying, and now we want to play with it without any, like, without holding back, without any sleeves. That is.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's really hard. Also, like, you know, the wild imbalances of cards, you know, like I have like a pool of like 65 cards and like most of them are green because I'm just like, ooh, Wailuli Wolf and Giant Turtle.
Oh, yeah.
And Dirkwood Boars, you know, like the, like this is that's where I want it. You know, and I'm like, ooh, there's like a almost entire cycle of 3-mana 2/2s with no abilities. You know, there's Raging Bull and Grey Ogre, Headless Horseman and Scathe Zombies, Pearled Unicorn, and then there's Noble.
There's not even a blue bear. Like, why? It's so annoying.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, Giant Tortoise ain't bad, though. 2-mana.
It's a cool card. Yes, I like that.
I once cast a Holy Light, and then I was like, I think I won't attack with my Giant Tortoise. I was so close to attacking with
it. So, I don't know. I don't know if this is going to actually make it out of Cube Cobra, but I'm certainly going to try.
Yeah. It's still fun to tinker with the half-done lists on Cube Cobra. But it's worth it to really push to get them just into existence, like be it on an online client or in real life.
Agreed.
But yeah, this won't happen for every cube. I have scrapped many ideas.
Yeah, same with me.
That's how it goes. Yeah, they can't all be winners. One last random thought before I forget. Somewhere along the way, Derek said something about how, like, one of the most important lessons he's learned is that, like, you know, repetitive gameplay is very frequently a bad thing. Can anyone tell me Magic format with the least possible repetition in in gameplay? We haven't talked about Chaos Draft very much, so thought I had to throw in a quick bit there.
Plug it here quickly.
I mean, listen, one of my obsessions is making chaos formats, and I absolutely love Chaos Draft. I don't Chaos Draft enough with you guys, so like, I don't understand why I love it so much and can't. Because I'm always working when you're firing them.
Yeah,
the problem is that I'm in Europe, and that makes the time for really bad for people who work a normal day job. So
yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, chaos is magical, and you know, trying to make one solely with the arena client right now, having a slow go at it. But yeah, I mean, knowing the both of you has made me like for some make this like a hobby of mine.
My arena client is ready for some arena cubes. I have stocked up on wild cards. I've never used any of them. So if you're ever ready to fire one there, hit me up. I'll be joining. If I can manage the time weekend, I guess.
Maybe hurt some cats as well.
You know.
Anyway. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Derek, for joining us. It's been a blast having you on. And like you said, really granular and enjoyable conversations. So.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I mean, I love podcasting and I love talking to you guys. So I really appreciate giving me the time.
Yeah, thanks for all the stories you told us.
No problem.
All right. Thank you all once again so much for listening. There are going to be a bunch of links, cube links for Derek, probably some Twitch, Twitter links, things like that too. But there will also be a Discord link. So if you want to hop into our server, chat with us, join our drafts, tell us our cubes suck, please do. Nobody needs to do it. So anyway, we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Happy healing.
I think I also found a fun title for our episode. It would just be, please just tell us how great we are.
Yuck.
Okay, so please don't do that.
Okay, no.